this morning is 17-1118 Dawson versus Board of County Commissioners. Mr. Clayton, you may proceed.
May it please the court. My name is Britt Clayton with Riley Carlock and Applewhite. With me at council table is my law colleague, Ann Zellner, and our client, Ken Dawson, is present in the gallery immediately behind her. Mr. Chief Judge, may I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal? This appeal presents two issues for the court's resolution. First, what is the standard of review on Mr. Dawson's substantive due process claim? And second, in light of that standard of review, has he pleaded a plausible claim for relief based on the county's delay by policy, which required him to sit in jail for 3 days and 3 nights awaiting the fitment of a GPS device? Both of these questions are for the court to decide de novo. On the standard of review, deciphering the case law is a bit of a challenge. There are some apparent or irreconcilable inconsistencies among some of this enormous body of case law. We view the Supreme Court cases as our Rosetta Stone. They provide the answer. From our review of the Supreme Court cases, it emerges clearly that the shocks the conscience standard is reserved for spur of the moment or isolated or exigent individual acts, acts not committed pursuant to an official policy. The shocks the conscience standard is inapplicable in this case because we're dealing with an official legislated policy by the Board of County Commissioners.
So I just want to make sure that I understand what you just said and what you said in your reply brief. You are affirmatively withdrawing a shock the conscience claim, correct?
We addressed it, I would say, in an abundance of caution in the opening brief and in the reply brief, and our position is if this court disagrees and finds that shocks the conscience applies, we believe that standard is satisfied, but we are not asserting that that standard applies. We believe it does not. The standard of review here is either strict scrutiny or the reasonably related test, depending on whether or not a fundamental right is involved. The county treats the right to be free from detention as some sort of newfangled envelope-pushing theory that's seeking mainstream acceptance. The county urges the court to be cautious in adopting this new fundamental right. Freedom from detention, except as punishment for a criminal conviction, has been a fundamental human right.
Well, if I could interrupt there. So Mr. Dawson was arrested pursuant to violating a restraining order, and you're not challenging that arrest, are you?
Not at all.
And so he's booked into the county jail, and he's given the appropriate due process for that, presumably.
He is promptly brought for his first appearance. Bail is set. Within hours, he posts that bond.
But anyway, there's nothing unconstitutional or improper about the initial detention.
No, sir.
Your objection is to the lack of alacrity with which he was released from that detention, right?
It is the county's intentional decision and policy that everybody who fails to post bond by 1 p.m. on Friday shall spend the weekend in jail, so that the county employees and vendors who are responsible for that process don't have to work over the weekend.
Why doesn't the standard that the magistrate judge applied from Bell versus Wolfish apply here? That case involved bail and we've used it in other cases, Dodds, for pretrial detentions. It seems to me that rather than jumping right to, a fundamental right to bodily integrity, we'd look at the cases that examine pretrial confinement and what the government can or cannot do in that context.
So Bell versus Wolfish and a host of similar cases involved the conditions of confinement of those who were convicted, mm-hmm. primarily. Things like, you know, double bunking, sleeping arrangements, and intrusive searches and those sorts
of
things.
Well, some of them have access to bail or not, right? Hasn't that line of cases been?
Yes.
In fact, that didn't Bell involve?
Yes, and the Salerno case would be what I would call the lead case.
So why isn't Salerno the case that's legally most comparable here?
As to the due process clause, it is the most applicable, probably, or one of three. I'll give you three. Salerno, Boucha versus Louisiana, and the one that I always have a hard time pronouncing, Zadvydas versus Davis. Mm-hmm. Those three establish, from a due process framework, the fundamental nature of this right to walk about the face of the earth and decide where you're going to go and who you're going to see that day.
Now, with regard to defining the right for purposes of substantive due process, Chief Judge Temkevich wrote an opinion, Sigmiller, that you all discuss, and then the next year in the Diaz opinion. Doesn't our court, in two published opinions, specifically say that under Glucksberg, you can't define the right with that level of generality? You have to define it at a fairly refined level of specificity.
For purposes of qualified immunity, that is true. Because, for example, in this instance, and some of the individual, all of the individual defendants were dismissed on qualified immunity grounds, it's not enough to say it was clearly established that there's a right of liberty. You have to say, to get past that particular hurdle, it's clearly established that having posted bond and satisfied all requirements for release, it's unconstitutional to unduly delay the administrative processes necessary. So, yes, that level of specificity is required in immunity, but not here.
You're saying that Sigmiller, that Judge Tepkovich was requiring a level of specificity only for purposes of the second prong of qualified immunity?
I believe that is the law from the U.S. Supreme Court.
Well, I'm asking you about Sigmiller and the subsequent opinion in Diaz. Doesn't Sigmiller, I mean, you may be intimating that Chief Judge Timkovich is wrong, because it happens every now and then. But Sigmiller did require, did it not, a fairly refined level of detail in defining the right for purposes of substantive of defining a right as fundamental, right?
I'll acknowledge that, or I'll reply to it further on my rebuttal. When I have a chance to look at the case, I don't want to take
okay.
your time now.
Okay,
I
that's
apologize
fair.
For that. If this court finds it important to limit we're asking for a proclamation that the right that my client presents that was infringed here is fundamental. And if this court finds that it's necessary and appropriate to limit it to there's a fundamental right to be released promptly when you've already posted bail and there's only simple ministerial actions that can be performed within a matter of hours, and to delay them for a matter of days violates a fundamental right, we can live with that. I don't think it affects the outcome of this case. I think it can be outcome determinative in an immunity case.
But, you know, the jail could not release Mr. Dawson until he'd been fitted with the GPS as a bracelet or whatever they use. But, I mean, they had to follow court order here. And, you know, there's some delay baked in there for sure, but he's not getting out until he gets a GPS device.
Well, two things. The district court judge that set the bail and imposed the GPS condition didn't say, and wait 3 days before you fit him with the device. It wasn't an order to impose this delay. That's something that the pretrial services department and the jailers work out for reasons that have not yet been shared with us. They controlled absolutely the ability to fit him with the device. It's a principle throughout contract law and the law of equity, and it should be a principle here, that when the jailer has the key in his pocket, and all he has to do is take it out and open the lock. He can't say, well, I haven't taken it out of my pocket yet, therefore he's not free to go.
Well, they argue, of course, that there are, I don't know how many steps. It's really quite complicated to have an individual set up on one of these systems.
They are steps that can be done between 1 p.m. and 4 p.m. every day of the week.
Would you win if there was no policy?
Excuse me, sir?
If there were no policy at all, would you still prevail on these facts?
If there was not a written policy, we would be relegated to the shocks the conscience standard. And that is our alternative argument. If we're wrong about the standard, there are courts who have found, essentially, when there's nothing standing between the defendant, the detainee, and his release, except some ministerial processing, and the jailer, whoever is in charge of him, delays that processing, that it shocks the conscience. That represents a value judgment that is valid, and if we were required to show that, I think we could.
Can I ask you, assuming that that it's regarded as a fundamental right, however it's defined, whether that there was a deprivation of this fundamental right, you talked about Salerno, and under the Bail Reform Act, I think it's true in every single federal district. I'm sure it's true in the District of Colorado. I'm confident that it's true in every single district in the United States, that if someone is charged with or without a warrant, let's say at 4 o'clock on a Friday, the district court doesn't conduct an initial appearance until Monday. And under the Bail Reform Act, they are required, there's no discretion about it, they have to be detained until typically Monday. And so now I'm not asking you to challenge that policy or that statute, but how do we differentiate what happened here with Mr. Dawson as opposed to what happens uniformly throughout the United States because of an act of Congress?
Because he had posted bail. And this is a qualification or distinction I wanted to make about Salerno as well. There's the bail, Eighth Amendment, Bail Reform Act issues, and then there's substantive due process. And they are analytically distinct. But there are numerous cases that the county has cited where delays in that first appearance, delays in setting bail, and the consequent delay in the release of the detainee have reached proportions that are arguably absurd. But once bail has been set and it has been posted and there's nothing left to do, I used to say this figuratively, obviously, there's more to do to fit this GPS device, but there's an hour's worth of work for the county to get the paperwork over to the vendor, and the vendor can be there within a couple of hours, and the detainee is out the door. This presents at least a plausible claim for post-bail intentional delays in purely ministerial functions that only these people could do. It is at least plausible that this is an appalling elevation of personal convenience and weekend leisure time over the fundamental rights of my client. We may not get there, but this is plausible. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. Rebecca Klimkowski, and appearing with me is Rachel Bender. On behalf of the Board of County Commissioners of Jefferson County and its Departments of Human Services and Justice Services, as well as the Jefferson County Sheriff. As Mr. Clayton has discussed, Mr. Dawson argues that his weekend detention awaiting GPS fitment under the county's GPS hookup policies violates his right to be free from protracted pretrial detention secured by the Substantive Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. Both the county and the sheriff ask that this court affirm the district court in holding that Mr. Dawson has failed to state a claim against either of these entities. And I do want to be clear, these are distinct legal entities for purposes of these claims. Mr. Clayton mentioned that the case on point, acknowledged that the case on point in this case and with regard to the jurisprudence is United States versus Salerno. Now, that's a United States Supreme Court from 1987, and it is a challenge to the constitutionality of the Bail Reform Act of 1984, and this was brought by two pretrial detainees in a criminal context. So it is the most applicable case. Mr. Clayton and I agree on that point. And the court made some very important observations in that case. First, while acknowledging that the right to be free from pretrial punishment is prohibited by the Substantive Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, the court observed that, quote, the mere fact that a person is detained does not inexorably lead to the conclusion that the government has imposed punishment. And I think this goes to Judge Baccarat's point about the delays that are typical in federal court under the Bail Reform Act to this day and throughout the country. Following that point, the court held that as a result, it could not categorically state that pretrial detention offends some principle of justice so rooted in the traditions and conscience of our people as to be ranked as fundamental. Now, that is really critical language in this case, and the reason is when you look at the Supreme Court jurisprudence with regard to where a right falls, that's the language identifying a fundamental right as opposed to a liberty interest. Now, liberty interests can be important. I'm not suggesting that they are not. But the court, and again, the case on point, as acknowledged by Mr. Clayton, says we can't group this right to be free from pretrial detention, that is not punitive, as a fundamental right. That is critical. I'll note that in Salerno, the court identifies the interests on the government side of the equation as both legitimate and compelling, so sort of conflating the two standards from the fundamental rights analysis and then from the liberty interest analysis. But even if the Supreme Court jurisprudence on this point is not clear, this court has ruled in Gaylor versus Doe in 1997 and then again in Dodds versus Richardson, which I know Chief Judge Timkovich was involved in, on this issue. In Gaylor versus Doe, the individual Gaylor was picked up by the Denver Sheriff's Office and was not brought before a judge or magistrate for 5 days. Now, that said, a magistrate did review Mr. Gaylor's file, and the day after his arrest did set a monetary bond. However, at that time, the Denver Sheriff's Office was operating under a policy of allowing detainees to post bond as long as they knew what their bond was. And if you don't appear in front of a court, it's difficult to understand how you would know what your monetary bond is. And in that case, what the court said is simply that so long as the policy is not imposed for punishment, but instead reasonably relates to a legitimate governmental objective, that is sufficient to satisfy substantive due process.
How about if they had detained the plaintiff for 2 weeks because they were so very, very busy they just couldn't get this done? They had just a swarm of other cases, and they just could not process this.
And I do think
that's an administrative pressure, rational basis, perhaps.
So I do think as the period of time grows larger than the government's legitimate interest, it becomes less and less reasonably related to that legitimate interest. So it's not uncommon for sheriff's offices and for counties to have staffing problems, depending on the economy. But I don't think that that alone is going to end up being an excuse. And again, I think the longer you stretch out that duration, the harder it is to say that what you're doing is rationally related to a legitimate governmental interest, even in light of scarce resources.
Where's the cutoff?
I think that's a very good question, but I do think that these cases fall somewhere in between the cases where someone is awaiting a probable cause determination or an advisement determination, and those cases set periods from anywhere from 9 days to 17 days as not problematic from a constitutional perspective. Now, on the other hand, you do have the cases that Mr. Dawson cites in his briefing, and those talk about 30-minute delays. I do have to differentiate the cases that Mr. Dawson would like to rely on in many instances involve ministerial tasks having to do with individuals who have unqualified orders authorizing and, in fact, ordering their release. And that's a different situation than the situation that we have before us. This is not an unqualified release. It's the exact opposite. It's a qualified release. If and when Mr. Dawson met the conditions set by the court order, he would be entitled to release. And obviously that does involve the county pretrial services division and their policies having to do with GPS fitment. So there is a role for the county to play in that.
Is there a fact question lurking here on whether the delay, the policy, the built-in delay is reasonable or not?
I think that it's a legal question, Your Honor, for this reason. The county has identified a variety of legitimate governmental objectives. The district court and Mr. Dawson have accepted those objectives as reasonable. And so I think that the district court correctly and this court can follow the district court's lead in finding that the county can make reasonable decisions regarding scheduling of the various tasks that it has to accomplish. So the idea that the county would set certain periods of time to accomplish certain tasks, just like the court does in, holding court under the Bail Reform Act during the week as opposed to on the weekends, is not an unreasonable decision for the county to make in allocating its resources and its employees' time. So to answer your question, I think that the court can make that determination and that it is not a determination of fact.
Well, I understood plaintiff's counsel to say that it is not reasonable to hold someone in prison over the weekend for the convenience of staff to have their weekend free.
Right, but I don't think that that proposed legitimate governmental objective that Mr. Dawson puts forth is the proposed
one
raised by the county.
So what objective do you agree on, the two of you?
So the county had identified a number of objectives, including administrative efficiency and convenience, but also the effective coordination between different governmental entities. This process does not only involve the county. It involves other governmental offices.
Has agreed that those objectives are rational. And
plaintiff has agreed that all of the objectives identified by the county in its briefing are legitimate governmental objectives, and those include things like victim and witness safety, coordination for competency evaluations. They're listed in, I believe, the reply brief at, I think, page 17.
But they flunked strict scrutiny for violating Mr. Dawson's fundamental right. That's where you part company, isn't it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Those governmental objectives flunk strict scrutiny. They're not narrowly tailored to...
I think because of the way the complaint is couched, it would be difficult to determine whether they are narrowly tailored or not at this juncture, but I do think the court can reach the issue of whether they're reasonably related to the legitimate governmental objectives. But I think the problem fundamentally with, not to be repetitive in word use, with Mr. Dawson's argument is this isn't a fundamental right. And so once you acknowledge that, and that's clear from Salerno, it's clear from Gaylor versus Dodds, it's clear from, Gaylor versus Doe's and Dodds versus Richardson, that the perspective that the courts have taken on assessing these claims is that the governmental objectives be, one, legitimate, and two, that whatever the government does to effectuate them be reasonably related to accomplishing them. Now, that's a very low standard, actually. It doesn't require that the county make the best policy decision that it could in that circumstance. That's not necessary. It simply has to be reasonably related. So
can
the county yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but as far as these objectives that you talked about, administrative efficiency and coordination, getting back to my colleague's questions, why isn't it a factual issue about whether or not the 3-day automatic every single case delay is reasonably related to administrative efficiency and coordination. It seems to me that the only real objective underlying this policy has to be saving money. Otherwise, none of it actually makes any sense to me. And so, but we don't know whether or not hiring this outside vendor and whether or not saying you don't have to go in and install GPS monitors during the weekend, we really don't know whether that actually saves a nickel for the county or not. So why is it? I mean, these sound good, but these are pretty vacuous objectives.
I would disagree, Your Honor, and I think that while Mr. Dawson identifies sort of a legitimate governmental interest in saving money, that hasn't been the thrust of the county's arguments on this point. The county's arguments are we have an obligation to make sure that we accomplish our pretrial responsibilities.
But some of what you're saying conflates with the legitimate objective of installing GPS monitors. Mr. Dawson's not questioning the legitimacy of that objective. The question is whether or not it's reasonably related to the idea that somebody has to inherently wait 72 hours for an outside vendor who was appointed at the discretion of the county for this outside vendor to come in and install the monitors. And so how is that reasonable, the 72-hour delay, how is that reasonably related to coordination or administrative efficiency?
Your Honor, I think that the county can make decisions about deployment of its resources. And by resources, I don't just mean financial resources. I also mean employee resources. So pretrial services, for example, this isn't the only thing that they do. And in order to accomplish GPS hookups, as you note, and as the policy which is incorporated into the complaint as an exhibit delineates, there has to be coordination with the district attorney's office. There has to be compliance with the Victims' Rights Act under Colorado law.
To install a GPS monitor?
To set that up. So
you're saying this outside vendor has to go contact the DA's office?
I'm saying that pretrial services employees who are county employees have to coordinate with both the contract vendor and with other governmental entities to accomplish this process. It's not entirely in-house within the county. Does that answer your question, Your Honor? I see that I am running low on time, so I do just want to hit one additional point, and that's this. I understand the temptation because you're talking about the Jefferson County Sheriff and the Board of County Commissioners of Jefferson County to conflate those two entities. But this court in its decisions has been very clear, as has the Supreme Court, that those are distinct legal entities. They're distinct legal entities under Colorado law. Pembar versus City of Cincinnati, that's United States Supreme Court 1986 decision. Bristol versus Board of County Commissioners of Clear Creek, this court's decision from 2002, discuss the differences between various governmental entities, and specifically Bristol speaks to a Board of County Commissioners and a sheriff in the employment context. So it's quite important in my mind that even if the court were to determine that it needed to reverse rather than affirm the district court's decision with regard to the county and its policies, it should affirm the dismissal of the sheriff. And the reason for that is simply this. The sheriff did not establish these policies. The sheriff's only obligation under the policies is to communicate with other governmental entities. If that's the standard for a municipal liability claim as against one governmental entity, anytime it communicates with another, it gets pulled into these types of claims. That's in contradiction of the case law that has been established in this jurisdiction. And even if the court were to find that the sheriff had some role in this more than simply communication, the sheriff can't release this individual, cannot release Mr. Dawson until GPS hookup has been accomplished. And the court order doesn't have to say wait 3 days and then do it. The court order says you shall hold this individual until he posts his monetary bond and until he is hooked up with GPS. Thank you.
Is the sheriff sued in his individual capacity or individually?
No, Your Honor. The sheriff is only sued in his official capacity in this case.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
I appreciate the opportunity to look at the Siegmiller case again. My notes reflect that it is not an immunity case. I correct myself. It's also not an over-detention case. This was an employee who was disciplined for having an off-duty affair. That should have been assessed under the shocks the conscience standard because there was no official policy under any expansive view of how policies are established. That was a one-off case. It should have been analyzed under the shocks the conscience standard. So I have to say that Chief Judge Timkovich's opinion in Siegmiller does not follow the correct standard. In Your Honor's defense, however, Judge Timkovich's concurrence in Dodds is spot on.
I ain't batting 50-50, great.
spot on the question of the sheriff's liability. And I think I could stand on the briefs on that except to say one more thing. We don't know what the court's order to the sheriff or anybody says in this case. It's not a part of the record. Ms. Klimkowski is speculating as to what that order says. All of Ms. Klimkowski's arguments are about the policies involved and reasonably related, so they're not specious. They're plausible. They're tenable. But we have to construe all of the inferences and evidence in favor of Mr. Dawson right now. And I could go on, as we have in the brief, about why those arguments are specious. It's a factual issue. We need discovery in a trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Appreciate your arguments. Counsel, excuse, and the case shall be submitted.